Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today calls himself Romes. He's a blackjack counter in his early 30s, currently specializes in hole carding and exploiting side bets on table games. Romes, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's a real pleasure.
Good. Glad you're here. All right. So we have lots of emails that we haven't gotten to recently, so we're going to jump right into those. One of those, addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Relates to blackjack. Somebody wants to use a piecemeal approach to learning how to count cards at blackjack. He wants to know if the Michael Shackelford's Wizard of Odds Ace 5 simplified blackjack system is a reasonable advance over basic strategy.
I guess I would say the question is, what is your goal? If you actually think you want to try to make money at the game, then no. I think that's not a good choice. If you want to try to take some, free vacations and, or take some vacations and not have them cost you as much, well, then I would say instead of bothering with the ace five count, I would make sure that you absolutely really know basic strategy backwards and forwards and in your sleep and read Comp City and try to gather your EV that way rather than trying to gain it by using an ace five count.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Richard. Like, the ace five count, I mean, it's technically over basic strategy, but you're not going to get away. A lot of people try to use that count because it's simplified, right? But you're really not going to get away from, bankroll management, Kelly criteria, ROR and all that stuff. And so I would think that people that want to even break even, or do it for comps, they're going to end up losing, more if they don't understand these other concepts. So it's almost like half learning, which in my opinion makes it more dangerous.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. So,
and I would also add that people who want to try to take those kind of shortcuts, I would bet they probably don't really know basic strategy all the way, and they'd be better time better spent focusing on actually learning basic strategy.
That would be my guess. I'm not into the blackjack counts, but in video poker, the people who are trying to learn simplified strategy and learn barely enough to survive are not the winners. Players
right.
who do well know the strategy inside out and backward. Another blackjack question. We had Olaf von Kura on the show a couple months ago, and he is into the KO blackjack system, and on the show he says it's better than high-low. Our listener wants to know, Richard, do you believe that?
Better? No, I don't believe it's better, but I think it can perform as well as the high-low. I guess you could say it's slightly easier, but it's not all that much easier. I would say it just depends on how seriously you want to take the game. I think the KO absolutely is a strong count, strong enough to work and make money with, as is the high-low. But again, if you're trying to learn a half-ass strategy, I don't think it matters which one you use. Well, actually, either way, I don't think it matters which one you use. If you're going to learn it thoroughly, either one will be fine.
Do you have anything to add, Romes, or should we move on?
No, I pretty much agree with what Richard said. I mean, my philosophy, I hate comparing counting systems. The system that you're going to make the least amount of mistakes with, and be the most proficient with, that's the one you should be using, whether it's KO, high-low, Omega, any of these, you know, systems, and people like to get in all these debates, and I like to steer clear of it, because as long as you're using one of the mainstream, you know, systems that has good betting correlation, playing efficiency, all that, you know, it really comes down to what you put into it and not the system itself.
Yes, absolutely agree.
All right, let's get off of blackjack counting and go into sports betting. We have another email, gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com, from a guy I'll call Joe. He lives in Reno, and he makes sports bets for a friend I'll call Pete. Pete likes to make several sports bets a week, but he's often out of town, so he asks Joe to make the bets for him. Joe wants to know how much is fair to charge for making these bets. One thing to think about is that you're talking about breaking the law. Getting paid to make bets for others is called messenger betting and is against Nevada law. Not that it's enforced all that often, especially not for small bets. Just the same, Joe, if you do this, it's best to keep your mouth shut about it. Don't tell your friends or anybody else who you're doing. The word can leak out. Okay, Romes, do you have any thought about how much Joe should charge?
Well, the first question I'd probably want to ask Joe is, you know, does his buddy Pete believe he's playing with an advantage? Is this, you know, an AP situation or not? Because if it's an AP situation, you're just going to run into the sheer numbers of, you know, EV. I think he was saying in the original email I saw something, that a guy, he bets like $200 a week. You know, even if somehow he's pulling like a 10% edge, you know, like, okay, what's his EV, $20? All right, what's he going to, you know, pay Joe out of that? Is he going to give him 10% of that, like $2 a week? You know, at that point, it just doesn't really become feasible. And if it's not an AP situation, you know, then at that point, it's, in my opinion, kind of like a cocktail waitress situation. You know, you have one friend helping another friend out, and while nothing would be mandatory, it would certainly be appreciated. You know, but at that point, too, you know, knowing it depends if they're also just, you know, gambling to gamble for entertainment, or if they know anything about the math, because if they do, then, you know, charging him any kind of fee is really going to put him up against a steep house edge. You know, if he's already playing against a house edge, now he's going to give $20 a week away. You know, that's really going to hurt him. And I guess if he's going to get paid, I wouldn't do it on a per session basis, at least. You know, they talk about that, and James talked about that in Beyond Counting. And when you pay someone on a per session basis, and you know, all kinds of things can go wrong. Say you win $200 this week and lose $200 next week, you're even. But if you pay him every time you win, then you've now paid him out of winnings you don't have. So it's a clustered situation, and I would say as friends, you know, figure out a small dollar amount you're both comfortable with.
Yeah, now, Bob, don't tell anybody I said this, but
all right.
I would advocate breaking the law and just booking my friend's action myself. And that way you don't have to run around to the sports book and make these dumb bets. On the other hand, on the really, really rare chance that that we're talking about a real winning player who's sort of what I would call a professional, I find it hard to believe that he'd be leaving town that much, you know, to not, if that's his occupation. But in those kind of situations, then usually the runner is allowed to bet some of his own money as compensation for running the bet. And that way you're not breaking the law because you have a financial interest in the outcome of the bets, and I think that somehow makes it legal or something. At least that's my understanding of the way these large betting organizations work. So, yeah, that would be what I would do. If the guy is really a winning player, then the runner can make some bets to piggyback. And if he's not, then just book the action yourself, and you'll make a small amount of money off whatever the guy's negative EV is.
All right. Did you want to give out your phone number, Richard, for people who are interested in the Rich Curmudgeon? Don't tell anybody, but I'll take your bets.
Right. No.
All right.
No, I should say that more than 7 years ago, which I think is the statute of limitations, you know, I did have some friends exactly like this who wanted me to find them a bookie and make bets for them, because, you know, I was the gambling guy, so I, of course, would know a bookie, and, you know. So I might have let some of those bets just go to me, and I realized that my friends were sort of degenerates, and I was going to lose my friendships with them because they were losing too much money, and so I basically just cut it off.
Uh-huh. And you gave them the money back? No.
Well, no. Well, it's not being ridiculous.
No, it's not ridiculous. So let's talk to Rome's. Rome's, when you started playing blackjack, you weren't immediately successful. In your first year with a partner, you played something like 300 hours, and you were still in the red. That, most people would have given up and said, this system doesn't work. How did you keep going on faith?
Well, it's actually, those are kind of like two scenarios. When I first started, I actually started counting about 10 years ago. And when I first started, I was actually extremely lucky. I think it was Richard that said in an old broadcast that, you know, it's always the ones that are lucky at the beginning of their careers that stick with it, you know, and I definitely agree with that. But I set up like $1,000 aside from poker winnings when I was in college and wanted to play blackjack. And so, of course, after practicing for a couple months, I'm like, all right, I've got this down. Let's go play. So what did I do? You know, I went and sat at a $25 double bet game and bought in for $500. You know, it's half my bankroll. And I had like a $500, per session win goal too, you know, just, again, half my bankroll, but I was really lucky. It's probably the best run I've ever even had in my career. I won 13 sessions in a row, and that's kind of what set me up, you know, to keep going. And finally, when I lost, you know, in monster counts, of course, that's when I really dive in and learned the finer aspects to get a more winning game. But now, when I teamed up with my partner a couple years ago, so at that point I had a pretty polished game. You know, I trained him, tested him at home, went out to the casino. You know, he played great. But our first couple months, we were just kind of break even. And, you know, the following 300 hours, that's where the frustration really came, you know, especially for him. This was kind of his first endeavor into what was supposed to be a winning game, something I'd been, you know, doing for a long time and promoted to him. And, you know, here we were in the red 300 hours later, you know, like, so of course he's, you know, questioning, and I'm questioning everything at this point. I hadn't had a bad run like that, you know, and all the time that I'd really been playing. So, you know, we questioned the math, we questioned our deviations, we questioned, you know, when we should wong in and out, let's shave it and let's wong out one more, you know, negative count. And, you know, so we knew the math was right. You know, we ran simulations and, you know, we're both big believers in that. So at that point we kind of took it on faith and really just knew we had to hammer out the hours to get through the slump, you know. So what ended up happening, though, is I'm really, really grateful for those 300 hours. You know, when we reevaluated everything, we fine-tuned everything to a level of precision that I don't think a lot of people really get into, you know. And so what came out of that was a really polished game and a lot of bags of tricks, you know, to move forward with. So
he didn't want to quit. I mean, you had the experience of winning behind you, but he didn't.
But he was willing to keep going. Yeah, well, we're really good friends, and I think that's one of the things, you know, and I felt bad for them too, because he put a lot of trust in me. You know, he put a lot of trust in the fact that I'd been doing this for a really long time. I presented him with all the math. You know, I trained him, and, you know, almost like a mentor, I told him, like, it's going to get better. I promise you. As long as you're playing right and I'm playing right, we need to keep playing. And, you know, I know he, for a fact, you know, was thinking about kind of, you know, how, if it worked and questioning everything, but he never told me he wanted to quit once, you know, and so we pushed through it, and I'm glad we did.
Right.
Did he have a job at that time? I mean.
Oh, yeah, both of us did. Oh. Both of us had full-time jobs.
Yeah, that's okay. So, yeah, so you weren't trying to also pay your rent and lose at the same time.
Right, and maybe that, you know, that lack of pressure on, you know, not having rent to pay, that might have also helped continue on, I guess.
All right, let's change subject a little bit. Early 30s, you're pretty young, and apparently you have the ability to look even younger. How has this been, good or bad for you?
It's definitely been both. I'd say it's been more of a disadvantage, you know, than an advantage. I mean, when I clean shave and, you know, razor, I can easily look 21, and that can just be a problem when you go to some places. I mean, a couple of years ago, I walked into a Palace Station, and I'd never even been to any of their properties, never played a hand of anything at any of their properties. I sat down at a $10 blackjack table, and I got five hands in when I bumped my bet to $20 and runs over, you know, here comes the pit boss asking me for my player's card and my ID. So, you know, I said, I'm from out of town. I don't want to collect them. And she says, you know, well, whatever, give me your ID. I'll make you one anyways. You know? So eventually she stopped even mentioning the card and just kind of kept hounding me for my ID. And I kind of knew what was going on, you know. And so I kind of told her, no, I'm going to leave soon to eat. And, you know, then she turns around, well, give me your ID. I'll food comp you. I'm like, I played eight hands. I've never been here. I bought in for like $200. I'm betting 10 bucks and you want to give me food? That's okay. That's what are the odds? That's really what's happening. So, you know, there was no one else young in that casino, though. I mean, we walked out, you know, it was really obvious that it just kind of stuck out like a sore thumb and I guess fit the profile of the counter. So I'm sure surveillance is, I guess that time in particular, just watched from the moment we walked in. But, you know, one of the things that is advantageous about being young, though, is you know, if you have any amount of drinks in front of a pit boss, I have found this just puts them on, I do not care about you status. You know, when you're younger and you pound a beer in front of them and order one more, you know, they just don't care about you anymore at a lot of places. And I mean, if you're putting good action down, of course, that's not really always going to be the case. And, you know, there's more things to do. But so being young and having a drink or two, and not just like sipping one or having a tonic and lime, but, you know, I'm actually talking about, you know, get my beer and chug it in 5-10 seconds in front of the pit boss, order another one. That sets the stage for them. That just puts them on, you know, I'm not a threat. And I found a lot of longevity and being able to hammer a lot of games just from doing that with one beer.
Yeah, I always looked much younger than I was. And for me, it was also a real problem. And now back then, they didn't ask people for ID so much back then. You know, it was considered rude that, you know, you would never ask a player what their name was. But it just looked weird for them for a really young person to be betting, you know, $500 or $1,000 a hand or more. Yeah, I always felt like I wished I looked older, you know. Now that I'm 29, I'm okay with how I look.
Yeah, I'm kind of like that too. I'm 69, and if I shave real close, I can look 68 with no problem whatsoever. Okay, now, you were, Rome's, you were a stand-up comedian. Maybe you still are. Now, is that useful skill set to have at the table?
Yeah, definitely. I was never a full-time stand-up comedian. I guess I'll give that disclaimer. You know, it's a hobby. I have done stand-up. I actually have material put together to do it again, you know, coming soon.
Now, that's gambling.
A little bit, I suppose. I don't like to gamble, so I tell my friends at least. But, no, it's probably one of the most useful skills I think that I have in my, you know, bag of tricks, so to say. You know, if you can improv or you can – every time I've ever been able to make a pit boss or a floor, like, genuinely laugh, every time I've been able to do that, I've never had a problem with the session. You know, I've never had any kind of problems with heat. And you know, even if I'm betting small and I'm a spotter or something for teammates, I never have a problem getting comped afterwards either. Now, I'm not telling people to go out and, you know, make a bunch of knee slapper jokes, but it wouldn't hurt to have a few, especially gambling-related jokes in your pocket that you are actually funny. Although then again, that's another route. I've told terrible jokes before intentionally because tip bosses, you know, they were moody or, you know, weren't in the mood for jokes. And when you do that, then they want to avoid you like the plague. So they'll just, you know, stay on the other side of the pit and leave you alone.
Do you think you might return to a job of stand-up someday?
No, I probably won't do any kind of full-time activity with that. I'll probably end up doing some sets over the years just to do it because I enjoy doing it. I really enjoy, you know, making people laugh and coming up with, you know, new material and stuff like that. So I'll probably do it every few years just to do it, but more as a hobby.
The El Cortez?
You know, yeah, what? You're actually the second stand-up we've had on the show, because I guess Barry Meadows also used to do stand-up. I think it's a great skill to have, and I really agree with you that if you can make the people in the pit genuinely laugh, it's a great asset.
Oh, they're having more fun. You're having more fun. The dealers are having more fun. You know, they're at work. That's their, you know, they're at their work. So they just see you as a source of entertainment at that point. So they like that you're there. They root for you. You know, they want you to win, and it just makes the whole environment a lot more enjoyable, and it makes playing a lot more fun.
Yeah, I don't know if Max Rubin was ever a stand-up, but if he had tried, he could make it that way. He's good. Okay, the El Cortez, downtown Las Vegas, is well known for backing off blackjack players who have the slightest clue. Somehow, Roams, you were able to spread from $25 to $350 with the pit critters there begging you to stay and play some more. Now, unless you were clever enough to lose $5,000 or so while you were doing this, this is mind-boggling. How did it happen?
The El Cortez night, this is probably one of my favorite nights of playing ever, just because it was so much fun. My teammate and I, a few years back, we were on a Vegas trip, and this was part of the 300 hours when we were losing. It wasn't going that great. We were stuck for a lot, and we were, like, on our last day of play. So, you know, we just kept hammering away and putting the hours in, and we hit a little bit of good variance, and, you know, we got back to the point where we were only down a little, you know, and then, of course, we're happy with that at that point. So we contemplated just calling it a trip. Our plane left in, like, you know, 8 hours. But I looked at my teammate at that point. We kind of always joked about it before. So, I looked at him, and I said, hey, you know, why don't we go do, like, call-ins and spread blacks to the Cortez? You know, I was laughing. It was kind of half a joke, and then he just says, F it. You know, let's go have some fun. So we get downtown, and the plan was going to be that he was going to go in first and try to back count some tables and call me in. And I was going to play, you know, the drunk rich kid and come in and just start throwing black chips around. So, you know, off he goes, you know, into one of the most sweatiest shops around. And I ran into a nearby casino to grab a couple beers to bring in with me. So when I finally walk in about 10 minutes later, I saw most of the tables were actually really full, and I saw my teammate sitting. So at this point, I kind of surmised that he got a really hot count, and he didn't want to wait for me to come through the door, so he wonged himself in. So I wandered over to the craps table, and I decided to lay down some cover. So this is something that I've done before, and when I say I'm going to go lay down some cover, I don't mean, like, you know, I'm going to play a little bit of craps, and that's my cover. Like, no, on nights like this where I'm going to play the drunk rich kid, like, I try to do exactly that. I like to work the room. I like to have a good time. I like to let everybody know, like, I'm there to drink and gamble and have fun. So I kind of, so when I bought into craps, I only bought in for, like, a few hundred, but I tried to order three drinks from the cocktail waitress when she came over, and maybe I intentionally waited for her to come over so that when I was buying in, because the pit boss, you know, he heard me try to order three drinks. She, of course, said, I can't do that. He laughed. So I told her, you know, all right, well, bring me a beer and a shot, and then bring me another beer, and I'll have it gone by the time you get back. So he rolled his eyes and kind of laughed, and that's the kind of the sign I'm looking for, you know, is he's already kind of dismissing me. So over the next, you know, 30 minutes, you know, 45 minutes or whatever, I actually, you know, pounded a couple more beers in front of him. And again, like I said, I'm not saying, like, sip a drink or whatever. You know, I put the beer down in 5-10 seconds in front of the pit boss. You know, it's crucial to have them see you do that, because they just think there's no way an AP is going to come in and chug a beer, you know, and play craft. And, you know, it just, again, it gets them to that level of I don't care about you status. They know you're not faking it. They know you don't have a tonic and lime. You're not just sipping one beer all night. You know, you're actually drinking. So there was probably only a few of us on the table originally, and I played from the don't, so some other guy did too. And after a couple of rounds, the third guy did, because we couldn't lose. So, you know, I was betting for the dealers a fair amount because I wanted to keep them happy, and you know, we were having a lot of fun and cracking jokes. And, you know, they were really happy to have that because the table was kind of dead when I walked in. After a while, my partner couldn't help but notice, because the El Cortez isn't that big, that I was being really loud and kind of putting on a show at the craft table, and other people did too. And, you know, he ended up leaving the table, and our craft table filled up with all don't players. I've never personally seen that before, but, you know, we had an entire table full, and nobody was playing the pass line, and everyone just kept winning. So, you know, the place was kind of going haywire like a crap table does normally on the pass line, you know, and I was like the leading act, just yelling, screaming, dancing. And this was actually right before I had ACL surgery too, so I was dancing around there without an ACL. But after a few drinks, you know, you'll do that anyways. But so I was looking to really move to blackjack though at this point. So we were winning. It was my throw. I figured, all right, you know, I'm actually up a little bit too, just, you know, getting lucky. So you know, go out my throw, I've got a 6 point on the board. You know, we have every number. And at this point, I'm dropping my chips. I'm slurring my words intentionally, you know, stuff like that. I'm kind of stumbling around when I'm dancing a little bit. So I look the pit boss dead in the eye because he's watching the table because it's the most fun table. And I just tell him, you have no idea how hard I'm about to seven out. And I just throw the dice. I start walking away dancing before they land. And all, you know, I hear, seven out, you know, and the table erupts. You know, and that just adds to the fun factor. And not only that, then, here's the perfect opportunity. I pick up my chips and kind of cradle them like a baby in my right arm. I've got my beer in my left. I look at the pit boss, and I slur like, hey, you know, you guys got blackjack in this place? He grins and, you know, probably salivated, and he puts his arm around me and escorts me over to the single deck, you know, face up, double any two, blackjack game. He introduces me to the female pit over there and whispers in her ear what I can only imagine was this kid, you know, a drunk idiot, you know, get him to play whatever he can or, you know, whatever they say. But at this point, I want to do a quick recap. So a lot of people don't think about doing this. You know, it's like I've been in this place for maybe an hour. My EV at craps was, you know, with tips, like minus 50 bucks. I wasn't really betting big. You know, but where am I at? I'm set up on a single deck, double on any, face-up game, you know, at the Cortez, one of the best games arguably in the country. And I've got a ton of chips on on the table, and I can basically just murder this game. And so that's exactly what I did. I just, when I sat down, I released all my chips all over the table in front of me, and I hid all the black chips. So I put, like, greens and reds on top of them, and I proclaimed to the dealer and the pit boss, I'm hiding the good one. You know, and she laughed and enjoyed it. And again, just try to crack jokes and little things here and there. So over the course of the next about 2.5-3 hours, I just spread from 25 to 350 with pretty much no betting cover whatsoever, other than my, you know, like drunken story and occasional dollar side bets for the dealer. And every now and then when I wanted to bet, I'd do it loudly. I'd go, shh, you know, we're going to bet the good ones. And as if I was, like, hiding the fact that I was betting the good ones from the pit, and she was just watching and laughing. And so every time I did that, I'd throw a $5 red chip on top of my bet. So whenever I won, I would just yell out, $5 winner, and that ended up becoming the phrase of the night, you know, because the dealers have to call out when they send black chips out. So, but instead of doing that, you know, the dealer would just turn around to the pit every time, and he himself would yell, you know, $5 winner. And it was just one of those things that I'll remember for the rest of my life about the whole $5 winner comment. But after I sat down, you know, I was no longer drinking and dancing, and they wanted to keep the alcohol going, so they kept bringing beers when I didn't even order them, shockingly. But so I had 2 beers in each hand, and I kind of put them on the table and pushed them forward almost like a color-up. And I'm like, you know, I don't think I need these anymore. And without missing a moment of hesitation, the dealer grabbed them and put them under the table and just goes, yeah, you don't need those. You know, so at this point, they thought I was blacked out drunk, when in reality, I was probably a 5 or 6 out of 10. But, you know, that's one of the things that comes back to training again. My partner and I frequently trained while drinking. And, you know, it was one of those things when I was teaching him, you know, we'd hang out for a Friday night and we'd drink while we trained. And you know, we would actually kind of drink heavy. So this is, you know, nothing new to me, and I, you know, I've never played completely intoxicated, but, you know, I can handle, you know, throwing a bunch of beers down and playing 100% accurately, and that's one of the things that I think is a fine line to walk, but is a really useful skill to have in your bag, you know, if you can do that, if you can hold your alcohol. But anyways, at the end of the night, you know, I went to cash out, and I was well above my EV even for that session, and the pit boss comes over, and she literally asked me to stay and bet more of the good ones because I was on such a winning streak. And yeah, so I for 2 seconds, I thought about snapping into sobriety and going, no, actually, I'm well above my EV for the situation, so I think I'm going to go ahead and cash out. I got a plane to catch. You know, like, I thought about doing it for 2 seconds, but I'm not gonna do something silly or stupid like that, but I always wondered what, you know, the look on the pit boss's face would be when they think you're blacked out, and then you just snap back into sobriety, and they realize, like, oh, wow, we just got played. But, no, I ended up hugging the pit boss and all the dealers and you know, waving goodbye, and it ended up being a great night, and it was just so fun, and that's what made it one of, you know, probably one of my most favorite gambling memories.
Yeah, a good act can take you a long way, but, and so I was going to ask, so you have actually sort of tested yourself under these sort of drunken conditions to make sure that you're really still playing with an edge?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, we were just kind of drinking casually when we were training, when I was training my teammate, and he's like, well, have you ever, like, drank and played? And I'm like, well, a couple times, yeah, whatever. He's like, can you still play? I'm like, yeah, yeah, of course I can, you know, being real sure of myself, whatever. And he goes, all right, well, you know, we're already drinking. He's like, let's do it. So, I mean, we had a couple nights here and there where we got bombed, and one of us would stay kind of sober for the time being, and we would check each other out, basically, while drinking. And we both, and I, you know, hats off to him as well, we both play with very, very minimal mistakes, almost the exact same. And you know, it's like after a decade, though, I would kind of hope that it's all muscle memory at that point, you know. But in a casino, though, I've never really gotten, like, blacked out drunk and kept playing. I mean, there's only been once or twice where we drank really heavy and played at the same time.
Speaking of your roommate, or your teammate, apparently he's cute. Once he was assigned a female host.
Gee, Bob, is there something you want to tell us here?
I got his number, Bob. You need it.
Well, good. Yeah. All right. So he got assigned this female host, and she thought he was really cute. And your teammate apparently respected her judgment more than mine. So how did that all work out?
Well, we were scouting a new place, and in taking the time, which, again, a lot of people, I guess, don't seem to do, and maybe the negative EV, we decided to check a bunch of empty tables. Because some people, they only sit down if they see a good game, you know, but we'll go check all these empty tables and see if we can find some. So I came across a really good game, and I signaled to my teammate to come join me, and he sat across the table and was taking signals from me. We played for a while, and him, you know, being the big better, kind of, you know, the gorilla, within an hour or so, the pit asked him if he already had a host. When he responded, you know, no, the pit made a phone call, and about 5 minutes later or so, a really cute young girl comes down to the table, and, you know, she starts chatting him up and telling other people he's her new high roller, and she starts flirting with him. And you know, I'm well aware that you know, these hosts do that, but in my own best judgment, she was actually flirting with him, and, you know, especially because later as the night goes on, you know, she was texting him after she got off work, and they were texting about everything that's, you know, not related to the casino, and she wanted to get together for a few drinks and things like that. So, you know, we kept playing for a while, though, that night. And another funny part of that, we kept playing for a while, and we had a few teammates on the table and only, like, one or two people that were just kind of random players. But our whole table finally started winning. We were doing great, And so, you know, he was like, I want to see, you know, what she can do, I guess. He called her up, and he says, you know, our whole table is having a blast, and we're just wondering if we can get a table comp to eat together. And she's like, you know, well, I guess, how many people are there? And he's like, oh, seven. And so without hesitating, she's like, all right, you know, I put, like, $500 on your car. You guys can all go out of the table. And, you know, so I don't know if this was a new thing for him being a new high roller or whatever, but I, you know, knowing how most comps work, I doubt he generated enough to just, you know, warrant a $500 comp on the nose like that. But, you know, this was just night one. So, like I said, she texted him, and they made plans to hang out the next night. And so she was taking him to all these, I guess, VIP lounges that, you know, secret VIP lounges that the regular VIPs didn't go to, and drinking Johnny Walker Blue Label. You know, after a couple drinks, I guess she was pretty forward with him and telling him that she didn't want to be that kind of host, but she did want to be that kind of host, and, you know.
I have these problems all the time.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right.
So did he end up sleeping with her?
That's right. I don't have any personal knowledge of what happened, but I do know that he went MIA for a few hours, and when he got back to the room, I was surprised he found his way back. So I'll leave it at that and let the imaginations figure it out.
Does this woman work for Caesar's Property by any chance?
No, she does not.
Oh, that's actually a disappointment. I thought I knew who it was. Oh, well. You're somewhat of a self-taught expert in Ultimate Texas Hold'em using hold card information. Now, how did you teach yourself to do that?
Well, the main bulk of my knowledge came from the serious amount of poker playing background that I carry. I guess technically I was a professional for some time during college. You know, I didn't have any other job, and I paid all the bills and for fun with poker. I got in, you know, before the big boom with Chris Moneymaker in 2003, and after that, it was almost like fish in a barrel. So it was common for, you know, all of us to be playing 100 tables at one time and just playing ABC poker even, you know. But not all of my experiences online. I mean, I played a ton live. I just played so many hands. And even at a young age, it's hard for some people sometimes to understand, like, yeah, I played millions and millions of hands. They're like, well, you're young and, you know, you look young. And, just, you know, a lot of the old-timers will scoff at you. You didn't play that much, but we logged way more than enough hours. But anyways, like when I heard about hole carding, you know, I was like, well, this can't exist. Like, you know, with the poker knowledge I had, I'm like, you're telling me I can play poker with someone and I know like their cards? Like, that wouldn't even be fair. And you would think, at least, you know, this is before considering variance, but so when I came across my first flashing dealer, you know, I had no research into you know, hole card strategy or anything like that. I was like, you know, I'm going to play this just to see how I do, you know, with my, you know, poker abilities. And you know, while each session is just very, you know, a little bit of variance and luck, I still did really well, you know, in the first couple sessions that I did. And that kind of led me into doing a little bit more homework, you know, and getting, you know, beyond counting and trying to understand it a little bit better. I had my teammate with me, too, the first time, and he didn't have a big poker background. So I was essentially playing his hands for him, and we kind of got in a little bit of trouble. You know, we were signaling a little bit, but he was sitting right next to me, and sometimes I just kind of said yes and no, and, you know, some things that he didn't understand, you know, why he was betting and stuff like that. So it was a little sloppy, but, you know, and we even got a little bit in trouble because some of these places they have, you know, oh, you're not allowed to help other people out, you know, it's like, you're not allowed to know other cards, even though, as shown in, you know, Beyond Counting and other places on the internet, knowing all the other cards at the table won't give you a winning advantage in Ultimate Texas Hold'em. So, you know, places that do that, I think, is just kind of silly. But so what ended up happening, though, was I ended up making a bunch of rules for the game, basically. I kind of categorized all the different hands into different buckets and made rules for them. And I ended up coming up with the rule set of about 9 rules that could take someone who didn't even understand poker or hole carding, and they can play with the vast majority of the edge that you're supposed to get out of the game. You know, one of the things I did being a programmer as well, I ran immediately to program a simulation of, you know, but this is before I did research into Beyond Counting and all this stuff, and I was like, how would I just play all these hands, you know, given these buckets and 9 rules that I have. So I programmed that, and, you know, you're supposed to get like a 13.5, you know, theoretical advantage on it. And, you know, I was getting about 13. So I was really surprised that, you know, the bucket rules that it had set up were that accurate. So then, you know, I read a little bit extra and Beyond Counting and things. But, and I actually was astonished. I don't think he even put the strategy in the book. You know, what he has in there, in my opinion, is not a complete strategy, at least for that section. So we moved forward and found some more teammates, and we've been growing, and, you know, we've got a ton of hours of full-time jobs. But things have been going really well, and that's just where we hope to keep going.
Did you just say you are still working a full-time job?
Yeah, I've had a full-time job ever since I graduated college, so any and all playing that I've done, and we still have logged some, you know, real, I mean, we're at like 800 hours this year as a head team.
How old were you when you first pulled, or when you pulled your first AP move?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily considered AP or just good business, but I didn't even realize it until after I started getting to APing what it kind of was, but I was like, eight in second grade, and my school had a business day. They were teaching us about owning and running your own businesses. So the idea was that every kid would bring in some kind of product, whether it be edible, not edible, whatever it was. You know, you had to set up a stand and create prices and posters and basically sell a product. Everyone got $1,000 in Monopoly money to buy stuff from each other. But I never really considered that because it was a competition. Whoever made the most money, you know, at the end would win these awesome, cool prizes. You know, I don't remember what it, you know, a cool super soaker or something. I don't know. It was something that I really wanted. So, you know, my mom ended up making me, like, these blue Jell-O cups with gummy sharks in them. I had sold, like, I had, like, several dozen of those. I marked up all my prices. You know, I got to work. And of course, you know, they're gummies and Jell-O, so they started selling like hotcakes, so doubled my prices. You know, halfway through my supply, triple my prices. And so I ended up selling out with, like, an hour to go, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just like, well, this isn't fun. I'm not, you know, I don't have anything else. What else can I do? So at that point, though, everyone kind of was just running around spending their money on things they wanted because there's about an hour left, you know, but I didn't have any product. So, you know, I went around and I actually took all of the money that I made and I bought up everything that everyone else had and in bulk. So, I was like, you know, give me, you know, I didn't necessarily say give me reduced prices and stuff, but I was just like, you know, if something was $10, I was like, I'll buy 10 of them, you know, for $50 or something like that. And so everybody just kind of wanted to get rid of their products, so they did that. So I ended up collecting pretty much the vast majority of everyone else's products, where I in turn, you know, marked them up at my stand and resold them. And I ended up getting more than half the money in the entire school for the competition. So I, you know, won the competition.
Pretty good. Outsmarting 8-year-old, that's pretty clever.
Takes a lot of skill.
Well, it's a mindset, though. And we all got to start somewhere. Cheating dealers, do you ever come into them? How do you know?
I think it's been said before that it takes someone who knows how to run a cheat to spot a cheat. And luckily for me, growing up with my younger brother, he constantly tried to cheat us in every card game we ever played. So, you know, I'd actually seen a lot of the basic moves by the time I was a teenager, you know. When I was in middle school, we had a lunchtime game of 5-card draw, and we would bet snacks. And you would be astonished to know that when we all turned our hands over in a 5-card draw game, somehow no one ever turned over less than 4 of a kind. No one ever called anyone on it because everyone else was cheating.
Oh, my God.
So if you
only had 4 kings, you had to fold?
Yeah, pretty much. That was a plus EV move, was to throw those kings away. There was at least a couple free pluses out there. So, you know, I was just thanking my little brother because by the time we were teenagers, he learned how to second deal, and he actually got really good at it. To the point where, if I wasn't staring at him doing it, I couldn't tell if he was doing it at all. You know, and I've dabbled in some, you know, sleight of hand tricks just for you know, comedy. You know, it's a good thing to do at a party and impress people and stuff like that. Nothing real, but, you know, I kind of understand the mechanics of it. My partner and I, when we came out here, actually, yeah, it was the same trip. And during the 300 hours in the El Cortez, it was earlier in that week. I don't know if I want to name the place or not, but we the first place we were staying, we decided to kind of play, you know, give them some action and play a little bit of a lower spread and play on their double deck game. And one of the first things I noticed was, you know, after losing for a while, the dealer was, like, cocking the deck. It was a handheld game. He was, like, kind of cocking the deck and looking at, like, the next card when he was getting done dealing from third base. So I started staring at him really intently, and I was sitting in first base, and I couldn't tell if he was second dealer or not off the first few deals. And when I can't tell, that's something that gives me pause for concern. You know, because especially having grown up with it and being privy to it for a long time, knowing how to do it myself and things like that, that just puts me on edge. So, you know, I was really staring at this guy's hands, and after about 3 deals, I was convinced he was second dealing. So I said something to my teammate, and, you know, we were checking him out, and I was convinced enough that we ended up leaving and calling gaming and reporting him, his shift and his name and the location and everything like that.
How did that go?
I did it anonymously, and I actually didn't get an answer when I called, so I left a message. But I don't know whatever happened on the follow-up to it.
Yeah, I'm sure probably nothing. First of all, I believe that those kinds of incidents are really rare in Las Vegas, and that if it is going on, it's probably not being sanctioned by anybody, but just some guy who has taken it upon himself, you know, to do that.
Yeah,
I remember a case that happened. I probably shouldn't name the casino, but this was many years ago. A guy in surveillance spotted a guy dealing seconds, and they called gaming, and gaming came in, and they watched the guy for a couple of days, and they could tell that the guy was dealing seconds, but it didn't seem to be, he didn't seem to be dumping off money to anybody. He just seemed to be doing it randomly. And finally, after a few days of watching him, they dragged him into the back room and said, you know, what the hell are you doing? You're dealing seconds. And he said, practicing. I've felt for many, many years that if you could find somebody like this, you know, there's the potential to make an awful lot of money if you can document it. And now, in the case of dealing seconds, it'd be really hard to document. Probably have to get a really good high-speed camera, you know, that where you can shoot slow motion. Although nowadays, the iPhone will shoot, you know, 200 frames a second or something. So,
but won't they turn around and try to claim you're using a device at the table?
So well, yeah, you would have to do it surreptitiously. Right. But, you know, if you ever could get video of somebody dealing seconds, it seems to me like you could have a really good lawsuit against the, you know, against the casino, or certainly a PR nightmare, which any casino would want to avoid.
Oh, right. No, I agree. I think it's really rare, too. Like, you know, on all the years that I've been counting, I think, you know, at least from what I've noticed, he was the only one I ever came across that was actually dealing seconds. So, but I don't think it was just him, though, because when the new dealer, I made it obvious at one point that I was staring. I wanted to apply a little pressure to him. So I wanted to see if he, you know, I basically was leaning over the table, staring at his hands, making it obvious that I was checking out what he was doing. And I wanted to see how he reacted. And when the breaker came up to the table, he said something in another language. And, you know, the breaker all of a sudden was literally staring at the ceiling while he was dealing, you know, and of course, as you're supposed to do, pushing the top card off the top of the deck when putting the dealer's hole card down. So I don't know for sure that was directly correlated, but it was kind of awkward that, you know, we came across him. He said something to the next breaker dealer, and the breaker dealer staring at the light.
All right, we got a couple more questions for Rome, but before we get to them, we're going to take a commercial timeout. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. In July, they're giving away $600,000. In casino-wide progressives. The big progressive starts at $10,000 and must be hit by $25,000. Every player actively playing when the jackpot goes off receives $25 in free play. A second progressive begins at $1,000 and must be hit by $2,500. This is estimated to be hit 3 times a day throughout the month. The new semester of free video poker classes begins Wednesday, August 10th. And we'll go through early October. It's going to be held in the Silverado Lounge, which is immediately outside of Don Vito's Italian restaurant. At the South Point, at the Palms, rather, from now until July 28th, they have drawings Saturday night at 7:15 p.m. 20 winners share $10,000 each night. Every day, Monday through Friday, you can swipe and receive 20 free drawing tickets. PFP play for prizes from July 4th through the 15th. You earn Walgreens gift cards. From June 18th through the 29th, you earn cash. Prizes are redeemed at a rate of 0.2% up to $190 per day. You keep the points. If you're playing between now and the end of this week, it is free play as your gift. That's through the end of June. Every Sunday in July, you earn double points on video poker and 10 times points on reels and video reels. On Wednesdays, 500 points earns you a free car wash. Thursdays, the same number of points earns you a free Brendan movie ticket that does not expire. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year. This allows you to get corrections on most of the game. In June, they updated their site, giving gold members a lot more benefits. If you aren't gold, you can sign up for a 7-day free trial. Check it out. All right, we're talking to Rome, and I got a question about sex.
Bob, you're making me the clump.
Am I making you uncomfortable? That sounds
no,
good.
No.
In advertising, sex sells. Have you ever been able to successfully use flirtation while gambling?
Definitely. I think every single person on our team has used flirtation while gambling. You know, there was a bit of an older guy that we found that would just really stare at one of our female teammates when she wore anything slightly revealing. And, you know, while normally he was a okay game, when he did this, he was a great game to play. You know, so of course we're going to leverage maybe certain things and certain outfits on certain people. But another great example was actually when I was playing the big player and our dealer was leaving for the night. So we stuck around to see, you know, how the next dealer, you know, was. And when he came to the table, he just was really flamboyant and took a immediate interest in me apparently right away. So the first few reads were no good, and my teammate gave me the signal to kind of chat him up. So being able to hopefully improv and kind of run with it, that's exactly what I did. So I started making some jokes, and we were kind of flirting a little bit. Nothing serious. I didn't want to lead him on, you know, too much or anything, but you could tell he was kind of getting all hot and bothered. And after that, I think the entire right side of the casino could get the read after that. So, you know, it was something that, you know, we don't come across all the time, but it's, you know, it kind of makes the game more fun. Again, it makes it more fun for the dealers, and it definitely made it more fun for my teammates who were kind of rolling over each other laughing every time I'd have, like, a sexually charged exchange of words with them.
Because your teammates all thought you were into girls.
Yeah, so they thought.
Yeah, all right. Now, you've trained for mixed martial art for almost a decade. In the poker world recently, poker players have been putting up big money to fight each other. It strikes me as positive EV for you to switch to poker, even being willing to lose in the process and get in on some of these fights. Yes?
I definitely feel that I would fare quite well in the poker world. It shows you how long I've been out of the mainstream, though, for the poker community, that I didn't even know. I mean, these guys make crazy bets all the time. I've heard of so many, but I was unaware they were actually at the point of fighting each other for money. I would certainly love to get in on that action, though I believe once they've learned that I've trained for nearly a decade, that my action would no longer be welcome.
None of them listen to this show, huh? Good. Go on, sorry.
No, it wouldn't surprise me, though. A lot of them have some addictive personalities, you know, shockingly or not. So it wouldn't surprise me, though, if a lot of these guys kind of took it seriously, because once you get into it, it really is more of a chess match than a lot of people think, like a barbaric cage fight. You know, when you get to a certain level where you're not just flailing about, and you're not just an amateur, like, every move has a counter move, and every counter move has a counter move. And so they create these chains of counters, and it comes down to either who messes up first or who outperforms the other in a counter. And that's one of the reasons that I love it, is I think it's a brilliant chess match between, you know, bringing your brain and your physical body in, you know, at the same time. And I would not be surprised at all if a bunch of these guys really kind of fell into it and loved it, and then actually got good at it, too.
Huh.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you're right about that. I have been reading recently that there is quite a lot of this going on. And somebody, I'm trying to remember the name of the player, but somebody recently who had never trained before made one of these bets. But took 6 months to train, and apparently, you know, did quite well after only 6 months of training, you know, against the guy he had made the bet with.
Oh, for sure. The first part of the fighting, you know, like this, in boxing in particular, you know, there's six different punches. And once you learn them, a lot of the skill comes from repetition. You know, the power comes from speed, and speed comes from repetition, and you just have to drill it down to muscle memory like anything else. You know, like playing poker and aping and counting cards and things like that. So, you know, with these guys' addictive personalities, I could see them all kind of not only loving it, but, you know, doing quite well at it.
Well, if most of it is intellectual, it sounds like Stephen Hawking would be good at mixed martial arts.
Are you willing to book that action?
That he would be good at it?
No, I'm sorry. It's an insensitive comment about somebody with certain physical disabilities. It was meant to be funny, and I realize in a politically correct world, it was insensitive, and I apologize for it.
I think we should let Romans handle the stand-up comedy.
Well, we actually have several more questions to ask you. We've been at this for more than an hour. This seems to demand that you come back on the radio show in the near future. Is that an option for you, Romans?
Yeah, that's definitely an option.
It was an option until the last joke, and now he's reconsidering.
Yeah, I'll have to reconsider, you know, given your taste of the programming here. But
yeah,
no,
well,
I would love to. It's been a pleasure.
Good. Well, we'll get some feedback, see if anybody else liked this. I'm guessing they will. And it was a pleasure. And we'll definitely be talking to you in the near future. Thank you, Romes.
Let me tell people where they can find us.
Where can people find us?
Yeah, we really welcome your questions. The show is always better with your questions, so send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com, or you can find us at facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can get the show delivered to you automatically every week at iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube, or sign up to get it at my site, richardmunchkin.com, and you can find an archive of all of the past episodes at bobdancer.com.
Pretty cool. Thank you, Romes. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Go out and have lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.